right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. We've got the Sunday morning general conference recap for April Fool's Day 2012, and that feels like an appropriate way to begin this conversation. I have with me, this is Greg. I'll be hosting this quick discussion. I have with me Whitney and Meredith and Isaac. Thank you all for coming on.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
I am so excited. So, all right, let's jump right in. We had Henry Eyring conducting today an opening prayer from Brent Nielsen, which I, who I presume is in the 70, and you know, as opposed to the closing prayer, Brent Nielsen gave the perfect, prototypical, short, unobjectionable, great opening prayer. No sermon. Anybody disagree with that statement?
I skipped the prayers.
You're like, I was getting coffee at the moment. So, and that, I wanted to make a quick note on that. We need Starbucks in the basement of every temple. That would just make things so much easier. And if you have not ever done general conference on a couple of cups of coffee, you wonder why you're falling asleep during it. I guarantee.
Oh, if I'm at the temple, how can I get the truths of eternal life if I'm falling asleep? Give me some coffee. Give me a French roast.
Give me some coffee. Give me an espresso. Anyway, and general conference on two cups of coffee was enormously easier to follow. So that's all I got to say.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Let's jump in. Dieter Uchtdorf, who wants to start off here?
It was beautiful.
Go for it, Meredith.
After feeling this in my life, you know, for the first time having someone that I'm angry at, it was just beautiful to be reminded that forgiveness is for yourself. So you forgive because it makes you feel better. It felt very Eastern, you know, life is, he even said life is to let go, to learn how to let go. I thought that was so beautiful.
Yeah. I think the Dalai Lama could have given this address.
Yeah.
Which was really beautiful. I think it made it very universal. I was wondering throughout a lot of these talks, one of the questions I had was, are we expecting non-Mormons to be tuning in? And if so, like, is that why we're aiming things this direction? And that quickly disintegrated as the rest of the session proceeded. But with this talk, I thought, wow, this is very relevant to anyone. And I think anyone can look at this and say, what a great Sunday morning sermon for me to be flipping channels and happen upon.
Yeah.
So I agreed absolutely on some of the Eastern notes and very universal notes there.
Whitney.
And I just loved how he said we assign dark motives to their actions in order to justify their feelings of resentment, because it's that whole collusion that you know, that so many people talk about, where you just like make yourself feel better for feeling bad by assigning the blame, and so easy to do, but so treacherous.
He responded. He responded with stop it. I mean, he said we have to stop it in no unclear terms, which was nice, I thought.
Yeah.
It was nice. I want to say this is maybe, and maybe it's just my frame of reference, this is maybe the best general conference talk I have ever heard. I mean, I was typing on Facebook. I was like, I could belong to this guy's church. Like I could do this.
Yeah.
Talking.
Because it was the Dalai Lama. It's because it was the Dalai Lama. That's why.
Well, it's just the best that human. It's just the best that human interaction and relationship advice has to offer. Like talking about how we regard ourselves versus how we regard others. How we give ourselves the benefit of the doubt. We understand our motives, and so we let ourselves out. We view everybody else simplistically, and we paint them in a dark picture. This was also, by the way, Oakes gave a talk a few years ago about righteous judgment, and this is a perfect repudiation of that absolute piece of shit talk that Oakes gave, which was basically giving everyone permission for judging people, and it just was – it's terrible. And this talk says – I loved how he said, I can't think of a way to explain more passionately or more eloquently – how I want you to understand that you cannot judge. I was like, oh.
I loved that because it felt to me like he was saying, I can feel this principle, and it's so hard to communicate because it's a feeling. It's a feeling of love that you have to just embrace. I can't even talk, like, you can't even really describe it. I thought that was great.
I appreciate it in terms of the sermoning that he was doing. You know, a couple of years ago, Elder Bednar gave a talk where he quoted Alma 5 and went through the Alma 5 questions. Uchtdorf said, forget that. I'm going to write new Alma 5 questions. Do you harbor a grudge? Do you gossip, even if it's true? Do you secretly envy? Stop it. And he made it his own sermon that was extremely useful and not a recapitulation of some other garbage that we've heard, which is an excuse to criticize or judge others. This was excellent and very needed.
The only problem that I can see coming out of this talk is more justification for just people who are already feeling like they have so many people to forgive, people who are abused, things like that, feeling more guilt about maybe I should give these people another chance when really you should just, there are people that you should legitimately not have contact with. That's the one concern, that warning, there are people you should forgive for your own self, but don't worry about letting them back into your life. That would have been nice to have a little bit of like, and if you have someone abusive in your life, forget about them and move on. You know, that would have been nice, but try to listen to the good part of it. Don't get sucked into this feeling of, but what about when I'm abused? That's what I was trying to say, because I loved it. I think it was perfect.
No, an excellent needed a point, very needed point to bring up. That's excellent.
The moment we judge another, we condemn ourselves, for none is without sin. And he said, this was such a great line. He said, the Savior has spoken so clearly about this that there is little room for private interpretation.
Amen.
And then he said unequivocally again, don't judge. And then, of course, the great bumper sticker, which between stop it and don't judge me because I sin different than you.
I'm going to make so many memes on that.
Yeah, that was just – it was just absolutely brilliant.
Beautiful.
So, Whitney, we've kind of trampled all over you. Any final thoughts on that talk?
Just the one when he was describing how we bring about this change of heart, he talked about doing it through the gospel of Christ, which was like – it was almost like a run-on sentence. Gospel of Christ, through the love of God, follow his commandments, love Heavenly Father, and then it came back to loving others. But it wasn't – it seemed to me like it was almost like a plug sentence, like, oh yeah, you got to do that through the gospel of Christ and through keeping the commandments. Like, got to throw that in there.
Like, yeah, I felt like the person who read his talk was like, don't forget to put in, you have to do the commandments.
Right, right. It felt like that, very much so. Like, the rest of the talk, you're like, yes, yes, I can't judge others. I got to look at myself.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
There's that, like, two sentences where he was talking about that, and you're like, and what exactly does this mean, and how do we do that?
How do we reconcile those two things together? That's so confusing.
Yeah.
No, I think that's an interesting point too. Okay, Russell Nelson, let's talk about tropical fish. Who feeds the freaking fish?
Oh man, the watchmaker does, apparently. So I loved you get in the middle, in the beginning of this talk, not right at the beginning, but he gets a little bit of the talk, and then all of a sudden we get Surgeon Nelson checking in, and he goes through how amazing the body is, and I'm like, oh wow, I'm so impressed. The church is an anti-science. This is great. And then you realize that this bait and switch, where all he was doing was setting you up for an irreducible complexity argument a la Michael Behe, and then he has the encyclopedia.
Denial.
Yeah, the Big Bang plug about the encyclopedia being created out of a printing shop explosion, which is just a William Paley watchmaker analogy derivative. And so it was just like, you just set – my note was, oh wait, the church is anti-science. You just set the LDS cultural view of evolution back 20 years, maybe like 50 years. I mean
– But it also is setting itself up to bash when science proves all these things when we figure it out. You know, it'll just cause a lot of dissonance in the future.
In the future and now. I mean, you get later comments about how we use reason and faith, which I interpret as we use reason and not reason to get revelation, because apparently we don't actually use reason. It was really upsetting for me anyway.
So let's go back. I have one quick nitpick, which is he talked about talking with this tropical fish, you know, and do they ever thank you? No, not yet. And then he says something to the effect of, because I didn't get the exact words, but and then my mind went to certain people that I know who don't thank their own creator. Like I was on this wonderful high of like, don't. I was on this wonderful high from Uchtdorf's
talk.
Don't think about other people's imperfections and judge them based on their different sin than yours.
Oh, yeah.
And Nelson comes in and says, and then I thought, you know, I'm really good at having gratitude, but I know all these people who aren't good at having gratitude. And let's think about how wrong they are for that. And I was like, oh, Dude.
Kidding. Anyway. Buzzkill.
So, yeah. And then families
thanks
are important.
Thanks be to God, though. Thanks be to God. That.
Yeah.
Thanks be to God. My Catholic grandmother, she would have been cracking up during this talk. She would have been cracking up.
Why is that?
Thanks be to God.
Oh,
all the time she used to tell that to me. Thanks be to God.
No, the meme that came out of that is ingratitude is a sin. Self-righteousness, what's that?
Self-righteousness is fabulous. The heart works almost indefinitely. And I was like, if it's like without disease or whatever, it works almost indefinitely. I was like, how did 80 years become near eternity? But that's and he gave plug to the capacity for reproduction, which I was happy about. Anytime we give a plug for the fantastic capacity for reproduction in conference, I'm probably happy about that.
He called it a sacred gift from God. I got to tell you, when I was in labor, it did not feel like a sacred gift from God. But that's just me personally. I understand
April
that
Fools.
April, yeah, April Fools.
That's the bait and switch on you, Whitney. You're supposed to focus on the that's input, right. Not the output.
Oh, my bad. The miracle of life. I was supposed to be focused on the miracle of life.
But let me talk a little bit about what he said about the family, because I didn't think, maybe I'm wrong, but he didn't actually say he talked about the plan of happiness being with families, but he never said husband and wife. Is that true?
Yeah, I think that's true. He kind of glossed over the family part. Like, he just started going, like, he started playing musical chairs.
His description was a natural yearning for endless association with beloved members of one's family, which I thought felt coming off of the forgive and love, and that felt like, yeah, the family is just about learning to love. Anyway, I feel like this talk, I could pick out a lot of different things in it that would give the church reason to accept same-sex marriage and this idea of the family unit being the best social unit for Earth, and this, like, where you grow to learn love. And I think he might have done that not on purpose, but he's got some good stuff in there.
Yeah. No, that I think that's interesting. He did intone towards the end, God is the same forever, but we are not. And so after
after
decrying evolution, I wanted to ask, so do we evolve or not? Are we developing or not? Like, and it's, boy, I mean, you don't have to dig into the God is the same forever. You don't have to dig very far into that trope to realize that it's completely indefensible, but okay. My wife pointed out, he talked about qualifying for gifts, and she was like, how often do you ever qualify for a gift? Like, I guess you have to qualify by turning, like, by having a birthday or something like that, but.
Oh, yeah, that's weird.
Were we talking about, conditional, unconditional love? Was that what
yeah,
that was?
Yeah, well, yeah, there is that. There is that. That's, you know, that you catch all these little things that spark up over and over again about obedience. It's just deeply in our culture. And so you find that in the fill in the blank crap that people put in their talks, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's all this stuff. You have kind of the keynote things, and then you have all this filler stuff that's just like typical Mormon talk. And you could really look into, I think, the culture that we see there. Any other thoughts on this talk?
Yeah, I had just one. I could go off on the creationism stuff and whatever, but by the way, creationism not taught by biology professors. Evolution is taught very well. Anyway, one thing that was really great was the little "you don't need a perfect body" spiel.
Yeah,
that was really great. And he says some of the greatest, you know, people or house and whatever. It didn't help, however, that when he was talking about imperfect bodies, he used the phrase "sweet spirit." I mean, that wasn't helpful. But
that was a throwback.
Yeah, that was a little throwback to anyway, great little throwback. But that was a great comment. I mean, that was the one little nice touch of.
It felt like it was, to me, directed to women who are unable to conceive children. But I obviously, my mind went on to other less traditional families that can't reproduce naturally. You don't need that working reproductive ability to have the spiritual growth that he talks about, to learn about love and virtue and integrity and compassion and service to others, which is the most important progress that he talked about. Our spiritual progress is the most important. So that was great, I thought.
And Meredith, that's another plug for, you know, if you believe in a biological basis for homosexuality, you can then say your body, therefore, isn't perfect in the sense that you don't, in your present state, have a capacity for reproduction, but that's okay. So that's a great point that you could bring that out to say maybe we're moving towards a post-heterosexual theology.
Look for that post. I'm gonna post that at FMH. So watch awesome. For it.
God be praised, God willing. Let's use that segue because Ronald Rasband basically had a little fanboy moment about Nelson and just quoted Nelson to Nelson. So
did he immediately quote exactly from the talk yes. that he just gave?
Yes.
I think Nelson quoted Nelson and then Rasband quoted Nelson formerly that Nelson had just quoted Nelson. It was an echo chamber.
I was checking my speakers to see if I'd had a feedback loop
a la One Eternal Round. Whitney, what? Give us your thoughts on the Rasband talk.
I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it mainly because of some of my personal experiences with my little brother. When he was 2 years old, he wound up in the pediatric intensive care unit. And you can just tell with Rasband, you can tell that he's suffering right now because of his grandson. What's going on with that? And he gave comfort to anyone else who might be going through the same thing at any time. I mean, he talked about the plan of happiness and how that brings reassurance. And at the time, for me, it really did. Everything he was saying, it's helpful for those who are suffering. So,
yes,
I can see that. I was thinking, I have to admit, so my son is very, at this point, you know, it doesn't show through, but he's minorly autistic and we definitely were dealing with that when he was diagnosed. And we thought a lot about this idea of an imperfect body and what qualifies as an imperfection. Is the autism in him? Will he all of a sudden be a different person in the resurrection?
It reminded me when Nelson said in his talk that the spirit gives you your animation and your personality. And I thought, well, except for if your brain gets damaged and then your personality changes, how is that the spirit? So it does beg that question.
That's my brother had traumatic brain injury as well as my best friend when I was 18. This all happened when I was 18. But my friend didn't have to have emergency room brain operation. My brother did, but it did significantly change his personality. So it also makes you question, you know, if our souls came from us to us and they were predestined, it brings up a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you want to talk to a neuroscientist about how do you parse out personality from neurochemistry, you know? How do those two separate? Help me understand it. All right, Julie Beck, Swan Song from Sister Beck. Meredith, you start. Whitney, I want to hear from you. What did the women think?
It struck me so hard how everything about the purpose of the Relief Society and the purpose of women is coming from a man's perspective and is given to us by men. And that was just pissing me off. But I do like the three tenets of the Relief Society: the increased faith, strengthen families and home, which is everybody because everyone's in a family, and help those in need. And those are things that we can look at expansively. We don't have to look at them restrictively like I think so many people do, which is within our own realm of, it can be a very... It should be, you know, everybody should have these three things as their goals.
Yeah, that was my question was, how is this different than the men's purpose? Shouldn't that be everyone's purpose?
Right. Yeah, exactly. I have mixed feelings about the Daughters in My Kingdom book. And
she did a promo on that one. She was like, here's Daughters in My Kingdom. It has timeless truth.
Complete with product placement.
Yes. Yes.
Did you note that the Relief Society didn't publish Daughters in My Kingdom? The First Presidency published it, and the First Presidency distributed it, and the First Presidency wants you to study it, not the Relief Society.
I have so many mixed feelings with that because I feel like that's such a letdown to women, but at the same time, our women are programmed to only respond to something that's from the First Presidency. So I feel like it had to so that the women would embrace it, but how depressing is that?
Interesting.
You know? But I, when she said the Relief Society is not a program, it is a divine portion of the Lord's church. It's a way of life for women. I have so many mixed feelings about that because I feel like that's an infusion of a nice rite of passage for women that women don't have. But at the same time, there's so many things that are flawed about it and are so like programmy and just like totally man-made.
Speaking of rite of passage,
it's not divine, but it can be it is the one thing that women have. So I feel like I don't want to say it's not divine, because that's super depressing. That we have nothing, absolutely nothing.
Interesting. Whitney, go ahead.
Speaking of rite of passage, she also talked a little bit about the young woman preparing for Relief Society, which is, I don't know if that, to me, it seemed like she was trying to say, like, oh, you know, that transition period that is so awkward between young women and Relief Society, you got to start preparing for that. That burden is on you to get ready to go into Relief Society, which is a little concerning, to be truthful, because that transition is awkward enough for young women. So,
right.
Oh, I just wanted to bring up the quote that she had from Kimball about distinct and different and happy ways from the rest of the world. That's how our women are supposed to be. And
gag.
Oh. Oh, my goodness. How? What is he talking about? What are they ever talking about?
It's like, on one hand, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's telling that our women are better because they're happy. So you damn well better be happy, y'all.
Right.
And then on the second hand, it's like, but it's not working. It's a failed prophecy. Our women are struggling. They're way more... you know, it's record depression in Utah that's documented. And so what are we doing wrong? It's not that we're not serving enough. It's that something else is off. It's interesting.
Something else is making us distinct and different and unhappy.
Right. Yeah.
But can I say one thing that I liked about it?
Sure.
She said, I forget what man said this was part of Relief Society, but the point of a Relief Society was to relieve poverty, to relieve illness, to relieve
doubt,
and to relieve ignorance. And that last one I thought was gold. The Relief Society is to relieve ignorance. And so that's, women are there to educate women, which is beautiful. It's a beautiful idea. And we're there to teach each other about what our potential is, which is beautiful. It's the one thing that makes it hard for me to stop going to church. It's that one, all those women there that I want to teach, like, you should be thinking for yourself. Like, that's the beauty of Relief Society to me.
That was John Wood. So I was going to say one comment from the guy who's hanging out in the background. Rightfully so during this talk, I might add. Anyway, to me, the one contribution that, like, Julie B. Beck actually said herself was, the sociality, friendship, and unity we desire are not the purpose of our association, rather the sweet results of serving together with the Lord in his work. I thought that was cool because it said, this isn't just a girls' club. This is serving the Lord. We are an integral part of serving the Lord, and we claim that, not some auxiliary, ancillary part of the church. We are serving the Lord, and we get this beautiful association.
Been to Relief Society? It was refreshing to hear that. I mean, because so many of our activities are, well, we can do this because we're supposed to bond. So we'll do this little fashion show, because it felt like it was trying to get women to be meatier, to be, to strive more for the higher things. And I liked that. I thought it was good.
And I liked that she wasn't quoting a man when she said it. She just said it.
Yeah. So take that, anyone who still goes to church, and raise your hand and give that as a comment in your elders quorum. And quote a woman for once.
Yes.
Okay, Todd Christofferson, gotta say, not my favorite of the new crop of apostles. And what did Isaac start us off here?
Okay, I liked Christofferson at first. I remember his first talk. I was actually on my mission. I'm going to tell you how young I am when he was called. And I remember thinking, wow, I really like this guy. His first talk was so excellent. And today I just said, wow, are we really going to insult intelligent scholarship again? Exegesis and hermeneutics. What's that?
You have no idea what I just said. So you laugh.
And so can we note that the two big congregational laughs? I mean, Tommy didn't wiggle his ears and give us a laugh. We had a crack at the Big Bang, and we had a crack at biblical scholarship.
Yep.
And those were the laughs that we got at our church. We laugh at intellectuals.
Can I tell you? It reminded me of The Devil Wears Prada, where she makes fun of the girl for laughing at how insignificant clothes are, and just goes on and said, but this is because of this. It's just like, you don't even realize how much all of our doctrine has come from this, and you're laughing at it. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, no, it was really upsetting. One of the things that, one of the comments on Bicomic Consent that I thought that was useful about that that could have just been a populist remark just to make people who didn't know those words feel okay about not knowing what those words meant. But I don't really think that that's what the point of the apostle, the apostle should say. We promote serious scholarship.
Yeah.
Go study the scriptures.
Right.
Go support critical analyses of text, which, by the way, exegesis and hermeneutics both just mean reading and interpreting text. That's what they mean. Explaining text. But I was disappointed in kind of very overt anti-intellectualism.
Yeah.
That was very, very disappointing. And then I guess he goes on there. I don't know if there's any other comments on that, but he goes on into, I thought, a couple of interesting things. One was he begins some apologetics that were basically, I felt like, directly responding to the recent botgate at BYU, the blacks and the priesthood policy.
Oh, yeah.
And Romney. Let's give Romney his fair share and the press.
And the press. And then we finally get this much-needed reading of that 2000 press release where it says, statements of general authorities, though well thought out, represent only opinions. We finally get that over the pulpit.
That's cool.
You know, that was an incredible
opens
thing.
Opens a can of worms.
The whole thing is a cluster. I mean, let's just – he starts off with the idea that he's like, well, there's a lot of interest. There's confusion that persists. And early on in the days of the church, it was difficult to keep it straight. So let me just set it straight. The 1838 version of the first vision, that's the one you should be paying attention to. I mean, that's the underlying – right? I mean, there's a bunch of other confusion about them. But it's really simple if you just listen to what I say.
It felt like the glory of God is not intelligence. It was getting rid of that, but the glory of God is like chain of authority. So you know when things are doctrine when they go through these lines. It felt
very
the shocking
line of
reasoning. Revelation. Oh, sorry. Oh. Follow divine revelation. That seemed like the point. And the divine revelation is limited to only those with the certain apostolic callings. It was
And only when they're speaking as a prophet, not when they're speaking as a man. So it's like,
but the other side of that, the like this weird circular thing was, he says, when he quotes J. Reuben Clark, where he says that members will be able to tell if prophets are speaking as prophets if they feel the spirit. So then that's what that's saying is, so it's not our fault if we said something wrong. You should have known the difference, dummy. You should have known that when I was speaking over the pulpit at conference and I said something and you didn't feel the spirit, I wasn't actually speaking as a prophet.
The whole talk was head spinning because he says over and over how simple this is. He intones very basic Christian doctrine, but then he goes into these examples and like cherry picks historical events, cherry picks Brigham Young, the one time Brigham Young ever said, oh, I was wrong. Don't listen to me. Like, you know, okay, well, what about Adam God? What about blood atonement? What about polygamy? What about racism? Like, you are using these examples of like follow, you give the J. Reuben Clark quote that says that's completely also mind-bendingly impossible to understand what the heck he's saying. Some people have an endowment and some people don't, and then some people have a greater endowment. And dude, so how are we supposed to distinguish?
Like, what a male thought about endowment.
What's that?
I just said, what a male thing to think about greater endowment.
some of us have greater endowments than others. The other Clark quote was the one where he says that first he says that if it's not something we say on one occasion doesn't necessarily represent doctrine. But I'm with you, Greg. What about if we said it on multiple occasions over a 30-year, 50-year, 100-year time period? Racism, polygamy, etc. Then can we say it? But the Clark quote says that members can tell when they're speaking as a prophet because they'll feel the spirit. And so what that says to me is, oh, so now it's my responsibility to know whether or not you're acting as a prophet at any certain moment because you're just going to talk, but I'm the one who has to decide. So am I the prophet now?
Well, ironically, I'm very comfortable
with that. I kind of like
that
because then I can say, hell no, I didn't feel the spirit during that, so I'm going to disregard it.
Oh, no, yes.
Right?
Yeah, so
it actually gives some of the power back to the members. Like, we could all decide together, nope, that didn't feel inspired.
But let's be clear, they don't actually mean that. If I say, yeah, so your doctrine on homosexuality and on women is completely messed up, that's, and I can tell because the spirit tells me, because my own internal compass tells me this is messed up, that's not going to fly. That's disingenuous.
Yeah. So what I mean there is it seems contradictory to what he was saying before, which is the prophets will speak for everyone unless we get it wrong, in which case you should have known better. But now we're the ones who are authorized to receive it. except there's this caveat where you can disagree if you want, but you can't actually disagree. So it was this big, just cluster cuss. Haha, you don't have to bleep me. Of well, then who do I listen to? Am I supposed to? Or can I just say, sweet, I don't care about that one. I'm not going to do it.
Yeah. Seek the witness of the resurrection, the atonement, and the character of Jesus, and then this is my exegesis of his talk. Do all this stuff we think is important and spend the rest of your life doing whatever we tell you to.
Wait, Greg, what does that big word that you used mean?
I think it has something to do with Jesus, but I just was repeating it.
But my biggest hang up about this talk is that he starts it off saying the apostles in Jesus' time set up all these things to try and stave off apostasy. They, you know, they were banding together. They were trying to like form this thing and it didn't work. And so Joseph Smith had to restore it. But isn't it great that he restored it? Because now we have all those same rules that are going to help us stave off
apostasy. Exactly the same.
And it doesn't do a damn thing.
And we have 200 offshoots of the Mormon Church to show for it.
But it just feels like D. Todd Christofferson is the prime example of who rises up in the church, people who are very comfortable in rules and feel the spirit that way. They don't understand. They're very scared of this idea of like, love everyone. Nothing matters. There's no chain of command. Like anyone can access God. That is very like scary to that type of person. And so it's interesting for me to watch them talk and how it comes out, how they see the world so differently from me. And it's just mind-boggling.
I think Christofferson is giving Bednar a run for the money on taking over the Packer chair. So,
yep.
Speaking of races, I think that leads us to the eternal race.
Let's go to the eternal race. Tom Monson got up. He had a teleprompter, so he was himself. The senility was not coming through. Tell us about Tom Monson. Who wants to take that?
I just want to say my problems that he started out with were so first world problems, and I felt bad for people in Africa. Like,
I thought he was about to tell us, hey, let's reduce our petroleum dependence, because he talks about planes and cars and we're all going around. He's like, stop using oil. I thought that's what he was going to say.
That's because you're a hippie. He's not going to say that.
You live in a fantasy world.
He's a prophet, right? He's a prophet. Tell us we're gonna kill ourselves, right? Like,
if you felt the spirit during that part, that's what he was saying, Isaac.
That is true.
I think so.
No, that's good.
That's what we just learned.
I think he was feeling his own mortality. There was a lot of talk about death.
He's been talking about candles going out and the dark night creeping in for 30 years.
But one thing that he said at the very beginning, which I've always loved about him, where he always talks about, you know, the things of the world don't matter. It's love and the family. That's what I've always loved about Monson. But it seems so ironic at this point in church history with the building of the mall, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Yeah. It felt very weird that he's telling us, don't be committed to things of this world, but we've given you this place to shop.
1, 2, 3, Bravo. Let's go shopping.
Bravo, well said. Weird.
Yeah, no, that's really great. I mostly felt like it was just trademark Monson problem. I mean, he really has not given a significant talk in general conference for a decade. It's just the same crap over and over.
He's given one significant talk for the last decade.
That is true.
Over and over.
Substitute over, in. Over.
Repeatedly.
Yeah.
Ad nauseum.
Can I tell you, when I was 10 and I found out that I had to wait through Gordon B. Hinckley to get Thomas Monson as a prophet, I was bummed. And now I don't understand why. But I was 10, so maybe that's why. He's really good at talking flare. To 10-year-olds.
I feel like the candle has been put out already. I feel like he's lost the flair. It's really disappointing. One thing I wanted to bring up Tommy didn't want to miss his chance at the anti-intellectual sputum. He says, answers to the questions of life are not discovered within the covers of academia's textbooks or by checking the internet. Don't use Google. Don't read, because you
but
won't
I'm
find anything
worthwhile.
But I'm
going to quote all these books for some reason.
I'm going to quote Wordsworth. We can quote Wordsworth, but other intellectuals.
Or we're going to reference a former atheist who was a socialist proponent with the Blatchford story. That was funny.
Yeah, I noted the anti-intellectual talk moment again. So that brings us up to three significant ones in this general conference session alone. Packer didn't even need to speak to tell us that intellectuals are enemies of the church.
But even going at that part of his talk, I did like when he talks about the universal question, where did we come from? Because I think that's the only thing that's ever connected me with religion in any way. And I even see it sprouting in my little 5-year-old. She's like, why did this people thing happen? And so I think that is one thing that is good about religion, but it's not necessarily, we don't have the answers. It's nice to have the question is all I like. But
yeah, I think that, again, I'm not a denominationalist here, but I do appreciate that secularism is missing out on that side of things, is addressing some of the metaphysical questions in in poetic ways that feed our souls. And so I agree with you. That's one of the things that I keep coming back to religions for.
You know, it's really interesting that you both mentioned that, because one of the things that I noted over and over again in this session in general, and we can sort of wrap this up, is that the paradigm that I am in does not even entertain those questions. And it's interesting. Like, I just don't think about that question. I know sometimes secularists do wring their hands at what does life mean, but we can't know. So I usually just go back to, well, let's make something good to eat and enjoy each other's company. So, you know, try and make the world a better place. And it's interesting to see how those fundamental paradigms create the question that's going to be asked. You know, and I feel like that is an instance of this. You say, well, where did we come from? What a religious question to ask. You know, you don't ask that unless you are sort of in a paradigm that makes that be a question that needs to be asked. And I wouldn't argue with either of you in terms of sort of the beauty of probing the meaning of life and everything. But I do think we see that those are questions that we only ask because we're kind of primed in a way. And I could be wrong.
Well, I'm gonna disagree with that in one sense, because I think that the study of evolution is in itself this question: where did we come from?
Amen.
And I think that in that pursuit, science becomes, I'm a scientist, science becomes a very spiritual pursuit. In a broad sense, we're jaded on the idea because there's some baggage that comes with calling things spiritual or religious. But I think that inherently, you know, philosophy was the root of science.
That's a good, okay, that's a great point.
I can see Greg's cyclical point. I mean, you don't, the question about where we're coming from is one question, and another question is about where are we going, and that leads to religion, and religion leads to all these ideas about where we actually are going, and it feeds itself. I mean, it just makes the question deeper and harder to answer.
See,
the more religion you add to it.
I think it becomes circular unless you employ a systematic methodology, which is, again, what science is. That's why we say, let's not make it a circular thing. Let's make it an efficient method of investigation and inquiry.
Answerable question, yes.
Yeah.
No, exactly. That's great. One thing that just occurred to me also is that evolution answers the question, where did we come from?
Mm.
And religion tries to answer the question, where did I come from? And so there's
where is my individuality? Where is my being? What is that?
Yeah, we call those self-interested questions. We call that an eternal perspective, where we say, that's the bird's eye view, is where did I come from? No, the bird's eye view is, where did we come from? What are we doing about us? So I agree with that. Yeah. We call it eternal, but I think it's much more immediate and selfish.
All right. Well, so any other thoughts on Monson?
He did say that we're not supposed to bob along the stream and just go with the flow. We're supposed to reason, and we were given the power to think. He did say that.
But right after he said it, I know.
Don't. Shh.
No, because I know. I said, I was like, oh wow, he's touting the power of reason, and then I said, oh wait, he's talking about prayer and using the scriptures. Not that those are bad things, but they're not the same thing. You know, I don't know.
Right.
But they were listed second.
Whitney, any other last thoughts there?
No, just that he called all of us apostates back at the end of his talk.
I did get that.
Said,
come
go
back.
Ahead and come back.
Come back. Come in. Come home. Come unto me.
Oh, he did? Oh, let's go.
Yeah, he did.
But he said. I thought he said it in terms of like Christ, and I don't know. I was feeling it in a very universal way, like come back to happiness and be in the love that you – I think you can come home without – going to church every Sunday.
Yeah. I'm too cynical to take that reading at this point.
No, but it was a lovely poetic little thought. I think that it had the rescue program sent kind of undercurrent to it, but I agree that I think you can come into yourself and come into your own awareness of reality and things like that without being.
Yeah, be at peace with who you are.
Absolutely.
All right, guys. Fantastic conversation. Thank you so much. The conversation will continue on the web, on the website, MormonExpression.com. And enjoy the rest of your brain damage in the afternoon session.
Thanks. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
All right. We're here for the fourth and final session. Do we count the priesthood session as number?
No, not five. Unless you count the young women.
Then we're
session.
The sixth session, right?
Yes.
This is the fourth and final session, the Sunday session. We call it the
boring session,
the cleanup session, where all the 70 who have to earn their jump wings go to talk. So it's not always the most exciting session, but it is ours, and we will make the best of it. I'm here with the ever-present and divinely inspired Zilpha. Hi, Zilpha.
Hello, John. Hello, everybody.
And we're being joined by another couple, the McRorys. Mike has been with us before on a couple of conference sessions, have you not?
Yeah, I think I've done one Sunday and a couple of priesthood.
Well, welcome back. And he has brought his lovely wife, Anne.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you.
This isn't your first stop in the den of iniquity.
No.
Nor will it be your last.
But this is her first time being recorded.
Yes.
Are you nervous?
I'm very nervous.
Is it scary?
It is scary.
It's like intimidating.
It is.
But these mics are so soft and fluffy.
Yeah, they're so soft now.
It's what's on the other end of the mic that's scary.
No one listens to this stuff. All right, so we're going to go through. We just watched conference, and you know, praise to the church on its technological advancements. You know, when we started this podcast 3 years ago, we used to have to go to conference, and we didn't even have to go to the priesthood session. They broadcast it the next day, and we watched this one real time, streamed through the internet in HD. And the church's policy of the geriatric leadership is starting to show cracks, literally in HD.
Some of them looked quite lovely.
They look nice. Elderly, in an elderly sort of nice-looking way.
Uchtdorf still looked okay.
I suppose. Okay, so speaking of Herr Uchtdorf, he did conduct this the last session, and we were led out by L. Tom Perry, probably the heir apparent. Elder Packer is next in line to take the mercy seat, but he's not looking too good. So Brother Perry will probably be the next president of the church. Now, granted, they're all kind of up there. I mean, no one would be surprised if any of them dropped dead from a stroke at any given time. I mean, I'm not suggesting anything, but we never know. But L. Tom Perry gave a good old fashioned talk. I liked it, but it was boring for me. It was about the Book of Mormon, but instead of just a talk on what you should and shouldn't do and why you can't tell us what doctrine is, he just went to good old-fashioned, let's talk about Mormon doctrine talk. So kudos to Brother Perry.
He said the Book of Mormon is a tender mercy of the Lord because it was preserved for us in these latter days. And he also he gave stories of deliverance from the Book of Mormon. King Limhi, who else was delivered?
There's a lot of stories about people who were supposed to be wanted to be delivered, but they weren't righteous enough.
Yeah, and the Lord was slow to hear their cries.
Yeah, because they were wicked.
Because of their iniquity.
But then, like, the poor in spirit and the people who were living righteously asked him, and he delivered them right away.
Right, but funnily, the people who were in iniquity figured it out for themselves, and they got out of the bad situation with or without his help. Wasn't that sort of, didn't they figure it out?
Yeah, I kind of zoned out.
Yeah.
So I did, he made the comment, hope I don't jump on you here, that neither the Book of Mormon nor the Bible stand alone or are sufficient by themselves. You have to have one with the other, which
yes.
I thought was interesting.
What, you mean because the Book of Mormon contains the fullness of the gospel?
Well, apparently not. It needs the Bible to support it. And
yep.
And then he shared the story at the end about Abraham and Lot, which the quote I liked was, "I don't know, but I believe."
Mm.
And then he jumped through a whole bunch of, this happened which had nothing to do with the story he was sharing. And then this happened. And
well, it was about the way that the direction that the door of their tents was facing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he knew that Lot's door faced Sodom, which uh-huh. led to Lot's downfall or led to a lot of the problems in his life yeah. somehow. And he thought that Abraham must have put his tent door towards the altar.
Yeah.
That was what he was concluding because Benjamin, King Benjamin in the Book of Mormon, had asked everybody to face their tent doors toward
towards him.
The Ramiantum.
Wait, no.
But wasn't he on a tower?
He was on a tower, yeah. So the tents faced the tower.
Well, yeah. And
but because of that, then Abraham's tent obviously
must
faced
have
the altar.
Faced the altar and not the wicked city.
Yeah.
What, but he didn't really say how that made any sense or why we needed to know that.
It was what he concluded. And he believed to be true, even though he didn't know.
Well, but good for Brother Perry for bringing out the Book of Mormon.
Yeah.
All right. The next talk was by Russell Ballard, also of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. He started out with an old guy lament about GPS devices and not knowing how they worked and how that's like the Liahona.
It wasn't a lament. He was like, GPS units are awesome.
And I don't know how they work.
Yeah. Just like, I don't know how the Liahona would have worked, and I don't really understand how the Spirit works.
And not to be catty, but we did notice in HD that he was kind of wrinkly everywhere except his forehead. I wonder if the old Ballard's hitting the Botox.
I am not going to speculate.
Just putting that out there. So the GPS devices, he talked about promptings of the Holy Ghost.
But a lot of his talk was really about families and that basically secularism is ruining families.
Yeah. He brought up, this has been sort
no,
of the
his
of the
was
problems.
Even weirder than that.
Well, he started with the polygamist, the quote by the polygamist about how families are the source of happiness.
Right. But then he was saying how this is a problem of poor people, and the cause of them being poor was actually because their commitment to family was low.
Yes.
Yeah. Now go ahead.
The nation's lost its respect for family, or the nation's lost its respect for marriage.
Yeah, this was a standard like statistical rant about marriage and babies are born under 30, you know, most of the babies born under 30 are out of wedlock and half the couples get divorced. But the new thing he threw into that sort of thing was the gap between the rich and the poor. Mm-hmm. And he actually put together, secularism and materialism, which I mean, I must correct him that those two don't necessarily go together. You don't have to be, there's plenty of materialists who are in the church.
But they're materialists because they have wealth, and they have wealth because of how righteous they are.
Yes, and that's the point. Through the rest of his talk, he very closely linked wealth and righteousness. As a matter of fact, he gave it as the argument for righteousness, saying that prosperity and education are connected to people in stable families.
Yes.
And then he said, well, we know that it's not – he actually even brought it up, said, well, there's a – causality problem of established. We have, connectivity. We don't necessarily have causality. But we know in the church that there's a causality.
He said the wealthy are more committed to family values.
Right. You know, to me, these are all manifestations of stability in the home.
But
you know,
he said the commitment came first and then the wealth and education.
Right. But he never makes the case, you know, he does a sleight of hand. He never makes the case that the lack of people getting married is leading to less stability in the home, for example. You know,
no,
that,
he just said that because people who are less educated and poorer are less likely to marry and more likely to have kids outside of marriage and more likely to be involved in crime and less likely to go to church. Therefore, their commitment to family is the cause of all that stuff. Their lack of commitment to family.
Yeah, but from my experience, the poor are the ones that go to church. They're the ones more willing to, you know, accept Christ into their lives.
Yeah.
But not in America, maybe.
Oh, maybe. I guess that's more.
Yeah, he actually said, full on, less educated and lower incomes, less likely to be married and go to church.
But he didn't cite his sources. So.
No.
He didn't.
And I know there seems to be there's conflicting data there because I know there is a connection between secularists and increased in education. But, you know, this is America where very intelligent, even heart surgeons, can sometimes deny the very foundation of science. But I'll leave that to a previous session.
And, oh, and he also said, so the way to sort of fix our society and communities is for families to come together, work and play together, and then the communities will flourish.
Well, I think the biggest problem with this talk, the biggest fallacy, is he shoots an arrow at a barn, then draws a target around it. Because he's talking about happiness, but then he defines happiness as success in the church, the things that we say are happiness. Because it might be that getting pregnant at 27, never getting married, and not being involved in church makes somebody perfectly happy. You know,
they're not truly happy. Yeah, they think they are. They're not.
It's a no true Scotsman argument. He's saying, well. There's all this stuff changing from what we define our core value, because he kept saying values.
And rich people have values. Poor people don't.
Well, having children in an unmarried state might very well be somebody's values. This is something that happens all the time. People say morality when they really mean my morality, right? Because somebody else might be doing something that they think to be moral. Like the polygamists down in Colorado City are having polygamous marriages because they believe that to be the moral practice. Then we look on our high horse and say, oh, they're all immoral down there. Well, they're immoral according to our moral standards, but not according to theirs. So you can't just say values, because what everybody who says that is really saying my values. You're not conforming to my values.
Yes, he did say wrong is portrayed as right and right as wrong. But he said, this sort of got me. He said, the gospel of truth and light attracts the honest and honorable and moral people of the earth. So obviously, if you're not attracted by the gospel, you are,
immoral.
Dishonest, dishonorable, and immoral.
Right.
Something's wrong, because as our income, as we've left the church, our income has increased. So I don't know what we're doing wrong. Maybe I still believe, and I don't think I do. I don't know.
He does give another backhanded insult to women when he says that all the sisters would marry if they could. Like, again, portraying all the women in the church, the single women in the church, is pining over men who won't pay any attention to them, and he admonishes the men to get married.
Yes. He said the church is the mooring. The church, not the gospel, is the mooring in the tempestuous sea of change.
He also said the church is the anchor.
Yes.
Which.
Come on, let's not mix our metaphors. Only one seafaring metaphor per conference talk. I thought that was clearly specified in the handbook of instructions.
So, he did have, you brought up the gap between the rich and the poor. He had a lot of political buzzwords in there.
He did, yeah.
Most of them from the right-hand side of the aisle. The rich and the poor, I think, was more left.
Now, Ballard, just as a matter of history, is our, you know, a lot of the general authorities were lawyers and doctors and MBAs. Ballard was a car salesman. So I think he's probably a little bit more on the Tea Party scale of things.
I got that.
More shooting from the hip, you know.
Oh, he said, living the gospel will lead and you're supposed to help your children to stay away from the filth on the internet.
Yeah.
And that people should do things in the right order. And he was getting pretty feisty, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a little bit.
Marriage and then family.
And if you're worried about marriage, you can remove that fear with faith.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was a standard, let's look at all the ills in society and blame them on not being part of the church.
Yes. And then he went in and named all the blessings or all the things that the church tends to do better on than the rest of the world. Like they live a few years longer. Yeah. They have a slightly lower divorce rate.
But there was no, I don't know if there's any data that backs that up.
Yeah, because he said if they got married in the temple and then kept going to the temple, that there was a lower divorce rate. But where are you going to get that?
If they're active and got married in the temple, then they have a lower, and I think there has been studies that.
Yeah, but how happy are they?
Well, yeah.
Well, obviously they're happy if they're active.
You know, a lot of this stuff gets tied into the fallacy, like we're talking about. If you keep going to the temple, that probably means you're happy with the church. If you keep going to the temple, your spouse, you're probably happy with your spouse. So those sort of things can self-select.
Well, and another thing is it's a bigger taboo to get a divorce after when you're an active temple married couple.
It's hard.
We have all met lots of people in the church who despise their spouse, basically.
Yeah.
But they would never consider getting divorced because it's wrong.
Because you just don't do that.
And they just stick together, and that's the way it is. Mm-hmm. Now, what they will do, and this kind of sums up this whole talk, they'll define that as happy. They'll say, here we can show that Mormons are happier because they have a lower divorce rate. That lower divorce rate might mean a higher degree of misery. you know, for heaven's sakes. Because somebody who values happiness, or someone who does not value happiness, is never going to consider getting a divorce if they're unhappy.
That's true.
Yeah.
So
he stuck something in there right at the end that made me a little upset. And that is that he told the women that no career can equal the satisfaction of raising a family. He warned women against taking that path.
Yep. All right. Our next talk was by Vincent Holling of the 70. Nothing remarkable here.
After all the emphasis about doing stuff as a family, he talked about his parents sending them away.
Mm-hmm.
So they can have a better life.
From Samoa to the United States get better educations.
And then he got onto the whole, you have to have a vision. Let's see, the importance of having a vision and having the vision and then acting. And then he tied that into missionary work.
That's basically it.
The next member of the 70 was Wilson. What was his first name?
Larry K. Wilson.
Larry Wilson.
Larry W.
Why?
Larry
W.
Why?
I was away.
Oh, I think the credibility.
Oh, yeah, it is why. It is why.
I didn't even know his first name.
This talk was directed at me, though.
You know, to all righteous mothers out there.
Because his wife had a lead foot and foot.
After that, when he was talking about parents who manipulate and control their kids.
You do that?
No, but I was, what's the word?
Manipulative and controlling?
He shared a story about his daughter was in a soccer game. She'd gotten to the championship and the final game was on a Sunday. And they didn't want to compel her to make the right decision.
They didn't want to make her.
They didn't want to make her. And
they did want to compel her.
They wanted to, that's
they
right.
wanted to guilt her.
But he was
her.
Talking about unrighteous dominion and flashbacks to my youth of being told I could make a decision and 3 hours of lectures about what the right decision was, but that it was my decision. And
yes, this
I made the right decision for me, but it wasn't the right decision for them. And so there was guilt and manipulation. Mm-hmm. And four or 5 hours later with much tears and just wanting it all to be over, I
You're
made
like,
the decision
fine.
They wanted me to make.
I'm sorry, Mom and Dad.
If people really want to understand the way Mormons sort of think and act, this talk is a brilliant study in Mormon passive-aggressive parenting. Because he talks the story, like you said, you know, about the daughter wanted to play on Sunday. So they, as parents, pray about it.
They read scriptures with her first.
Read scriptures about it and give her a lecture, telling her why it's not right.
Told her to pray about it.
Then they tell her to go pray about it, and she comes back and says, I'm fine with it. And then they go through another round of this.
Mm-hmm. Then they say, are you sure? Blah, 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 blah.
So, you know, she's got hours and hours of lecture disproving parents, telling her how bad it is. She goes to church all the time, saying not. And then she plays. And then at the end, she comes
after
to...
After the game.
And he didn't say if she won or lost.
She comes to her parents and say, yeah, I felt bad. Well, of course she felt bad. I mean, that's what they'd been loading the gun up to do.
And I'm sure Mom was on the... I don't know, but I believe... The mom was on the sidelines in her church clothes, probably crying because her daughter was out breaking the Sabbath. And what kid doesn't want that?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. So, you know, his talk is on unrighteous dominion, which is good, which is necessary in the church and begs all kinds of questions about the way the church is run. But we'll put that aside for now. But then, you know, then he talks of the statement value and purpose of obedience. You know, they can't get away from talking about unrighteous dominion without putting it on the shoulders of those who have to obey the you know, it's like they start heading to the right place, but they always take the wrong left turn.
Well, the focus isn't on the dominion, which is the problem. You shouldn't be dominating other people or manipulating them. There seems to be an emphasis on the unrighteous part of it.
But
righteous dominion's cool. You can manipulate people as long as you think you're doing the right thing.
Right, right.
They say you can't force people to do the right thing. And that compulsion makes people feel incompetent. If you're making them do something, then they feel like they can't do it or they can't make decisions for themselves.
Right. There was one thing that redeemed the whole talk.
Which was good.
Me. Yeah, I thought it was a good talk. And what redeemed it all for me is he talked about, because of people's actions, that individuals lose their trust in God's love, or basically, if you run a heavy-handed, you know, tight ship, then they won't see this more
loving
simple
God.
Christian gospel message, because it gets interfered by you and your priesthood authority.
Don't people oftentimes sort of see God the way they see their dad?
I think that's common. You know, people, that's been argued that everybody sees God as just an extension of their father. And I think by extension, they see God as an extension of authority. So the way the church runs and operates is the way people are going to model God. And the church basically says that, that there's this divine order of things that starts in the temple and they're just following instruction and whatever the stake president says, what the area authority tells them and on up to Jesus. So I think that's a really good, admonishment. I would, because there's so many lay leaders in the church, you know, bishops and stake presidents, my advice to them would make this a stronger message, and you don't have to blame the victim in the middle of the talk. You don't have to talk about obedience, you know.
He did name drop Monson. He said in his biography, it talked about Ann Dibbs, who we I just learned recently is the first counselor in the Young Women's presidency. Or second counselor, one of those. And the thing that Monson would do when Anne would walk into the house is he'd say,
Anne's his daughter-in-law, right? No, it's his daughter. It's his daughter, yeah.
Oh, look who's here. And aren't we glad? And isn't she beautiful? And that would always make Anne feel special. Hmm. So that's the kind of father everyone should be, apparently.
All right. The next 70 was David F. Evans. And he talked about efforts for reactivation. Nothing real notable there.
It was just your regular vanilla missionary talk, but it wasn't offensive or anything.
He did say to teach children the principles of the gospel and prepare them for their 8-year-old baptisms.
Yeah.
I missed that too.
At the beginning.
Our next member of the 70 was Paul Piper. I like his name. He talked about the sacred.
The sacred. And if you were to play a drinking game with this talk,
oh, you'd have been hammered.
You would have been, you'd be dead by the end of it.
So he kind of started out by talking about recognizing the sacred. And this is a typical, you know, Mormon thing where he says you recognize the sacred and then he immediately tells you what it is. It's authority, scriptures, and prophets.
Well, he tells you it's difficult to distinguish, but you have to live your life by it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is a sleight of hand that happens in church all the time. He says sacred is sacred because its source is heavenly. And because of the structure of the church and how they claim to be spokesmen for the divine, they can just kind of play the sacred umbrella over everything they do. So that you can't have any opposition or any criticism or even point out that something might not be the, you know, just like you can't even have a better idea.
Right. He said sacred things are to be treated with care and deference. And he said about not being able to interpret them correctly. He said feelings and impressions are so subtle that we may attribute them to reason or intuition.
Yeah, of course we may. The second half of his talk, he talked a lot about the opposition of he juxtaposed sacred to the secular. And, you know,
opposite of sacred is profane or secular.
Yeah, he said the opposite is secular, but then he went on to say that the secular is needed and is valued. And he said knowledge of the secular is essential, but sacred trumps that. My challenge to somebody who has the priesthood and has this divine church, and I have read enough of church authorities, just prophets, seers, and revelators, tell you they have said something clearly on everything you could possibly need to know. You do not have to open a textbook. They've spoken on every subject, from what kind of grain to eat to you. As a good Mormon, you do not have to make any decisions. The brethren have spoken everything you need to know to live this life. So I don't understand his contention that you have to learn to put the sacred in. If the sacred is profane, you don't need it at all. Like, why go to college? Just pray, right?
Yeah.
One thing that was disturbing is that he said there were those who choose to abandon even one sacred thing will find themselves morally adrift on a secular sea.
Yes.
Now, this there were a few talks, and this one kind of capped it off for me. When I left the church, there were a number of experiences that led me there, but the most impressionable one for me was I'd prayed because the church is a big deal. Well, the gospel is a big deal. And this was my entire family's future at stake. And I had prayed and I had fasted and I wasn't looking at porn. I was reading the Book of Mormon. I was doing everything I possibly could to get an answer to a prayer. And I received an answer to a prayer wherever it came from that told me the church was not true. It was a very sacred and very strong and powerful thing for me.
Maybe it was reason or intuition.
Anything here. I know where it came from now, but it just didn't fit with any of these talks. They kept talking about how, you know, you listen to the promptings of the Spirit. My promptings of the Spirit, whatever it was that I got, have led me in a direction completely opposite from everything that was said in this conference.
Right. Well, it obviously wasn't the Spirit then, because the Spirit only witnesses of the truthfulness of the church and of, you know, the gospel.
Which, it's just an interesting situation for me. Yeah. It was a very sacred experience for me that is completely opposite to everything here.
Well, what I think all people, whether they be secularist or religious people, have what they would define as sacred experience. What I find annoying about the church and about conference, I mean, they have 10 hours. They do twice a year. They could start getting into some details. You are a member of the 70. In the old days of the church, they would have called him an apostle of Jesus Christ. Why don't you tell us? Why don't you give us some guidelines as to what in the secular we should avoid? It's not that hard. Mm-hmm. We're all running into the same sort of stuff.
Well, filth on the internet. They did mention that.
Well, I mean, they don't want us looking at boobies. That's clear. But I mean, I hope this wasn't just a talk about porn again. I mean,
I didn't get the feeling it was.
No, it's just about obeying the promptings that you get that lead you to Christ and the church.
All I'm saying
is ignoring everything that leads you away.
On this end of the scale, you have don't wear two earrings, like very minutiae.
Very specific.
Don't look at naked bodies, very specific. And over here, you have this thing way up in the air. These guys are supposed to have God's word for us today. Earrings is not one of the big problems. I dare I say even porn is not one of the big problems in the world today.
What would you say is a big problem in the world?
Like
religion,
global terrorism, and hunger, and I mean, there are huge problems we're dealing with. Look, from a believing standpoint, the question of like the origin of man, evolution. You know, so much 90% of what you're going to read in your textbooks, you know, on a freshman level in college, contradicts teachings of the prophets, seers, and revelators. Why don't they get into that? Give us a guide to living in a secular world instead of just saying. Some PG-13 movies are okay. R-rated movies should be avoided.
They don't have a good response to secularism. All they can say is it's scary out there, and you need to stay close to home and close to church.
But they should have a good response.
They should.
That's the problem.
Right.
But they don't. They don't know what to say or do.
It's like, what's actionable? And when they give actionable stuff, it's like nonsensical. Skinny jeans? Really? That's the problem?
But they're so sexy.
and the problem with that legalistic tradition is it leads to problems where you say things like, oh, Sister Jensen graduated from college, has a career, she didn't find anybody to get married, so she went down to the fertility clinic and got herself impregnated.
Because she wanted to be a mother.
That's obviously bad because mothers have to be in marriages. But you can have brother and sister Smith who have 17 kids. They fight like cats and dogs. They're poor. They make bad decisions. But they're okay because they go to the temple. You know, that's what happens when you have a legalistic system. Because you just define these black and white rules and you're not able to say, you know, make good. Why don't they give better guidance, you know?
Wait, first you say you don't like a legalistic system and then you say you want more specifics.
Okay, once again, go to a college course. Like they will teach you the principles of physics, like the laws of physics, and then they will teach you application. And as a matter of fact, what the tests usually do is they will show problems that you've never seen before to make sure you understand those principles. So they take these abstract principles of the universe and apply them so that you can go and make widgets and refrigerators and stuff like that, right? That's the value of physics. Now, they could go down in a third grade sort of style, because the church is still teaching third grade physics. And just tell you that if you drop a clay ball from the ceiling, it'll hit the floor. That's what the church keeps telling you over and over again. So I'm saying there's these two scales. There's one where you're completely philosophical in the abstract. They have words like, you know, charity is the pure love of God that mean nothing to anybody, right? Or you can get down, don't wear two earrings in your ear. There's this vast middle. And why don't these guys take some time to go in the middle, you know?
Because every time they do...
Then I'll criticize them for that, too.
Yes. Right. They can't say anything that they wouldn't get criticized about. So they prefer to just say what's in the scriptures.
I suppose. I mean, my criticism, to be fair, is a little bit, they can't win. But they're the ones who are saying they're prophets, seers, and revelators. They're the ones who are saying they're their only true church and that they speak for the world today.
Right.
You know?
And almost every one of them, surprisingly, said, you know, the apostles are the chosen witnesses for God.
Right.
They say that of themselves.
And they say over and over again, look to the prophets and look to conference. And I'm saying, I'm looking to conference and I'm not walking away with even knowing what Mormons are supposed to be doing differently or, you know, so I don't think that and we'll give the wrap up here in a second. Let's move on to, let's move on to Neil Anderson of the 12, the junior apostle. Or is Cook?
This is,
who's the, I think Cook's ahead of Anderson.
I think Anderson is the baby.
I remember Cook getting in. I don't remember Anderson. Yeah, I don't either. So.
And he was the only one that was of the 12.
Well, at the end.
Well,
there were two at the beginning.
Yeah. Bednar and,
Perry and,
Perry and Ballard.
Right. That's right.
Moral fiber is disintegrating the world. And the world is moving away from spirituality.
Yeah, he talked about being a Christian. He talked about discipleship and obedience again. And
but he did say there's a growing disbelief and disregard for Christ and his teachings.
Yeah, let's skip ahead to the wrap up. Monson,
do we want to hit the Haiti thing?
Yeah.
So
just because you didn't write down any notes from this talk, John, doesn't mean.
I got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 bullet points. Go ahead.
Okay, so the story is there was this horrific earthquake in Haiti at the beginning of 2010, and there was a family where the dad was at work, the mom was at the church, and the three kids. I think they're aged what? 7, 5, and 3.
5, 3, and 1.
5, 3, and 1. Okay. They were in the apartment being watched by someone. The earthquake hit and the building was flattened.
No, I don't think they were being watched by anyone.
There was a friend with them or something.
Oh, okay.
So
they were in the apartment.
So they're in the apartment.
Mom
alone.
Was at church. Dad was at work.
The earthquake hits. The apartment building is flattened. They arrive home and are just devastated that they've lost their kids. And they pray and they plead with God.
And they keep walking around the rubble, listening.
And the neighbors are trying to comfort them because they've lost their kids. And he hears this little voice. He hears a baby's cry. And then he hears his oldest son singing,
I am a child of God.
Or whatever, I guess, the French version of that is. And the neighbors all dig down there and they find the kids.
All three of them.
And
God had saved them. It was a miracle for this family. But lots of other kids.
All the other parents out there died. Who were begging and pleading God to save their kids.
Ignored.
Were not faithful enough.
And to me, this really represents the schism. I mean, it's awful things like this happen. And it's joyful that they were able to reunite with their children. But this is the real schism between a secular worldview and a religious worldview. In a secular worldview, tragedy happens. So we need to either stop tragedy where we can, so we have building codes to keep buildings from collapsing during earthquakes. That's a secular response. Or we form the Red Cross or other organizations like that.
Or we're a helpful neighbor and help undig a baby.
Right. Yeah. We try to put in the social safety net. We try to make sure that we can help. And when we look and say that tragedy happened, we're going to be like, tragedies happen and we're all going to meet our ultimate fate at some point, but let's do what we can to mitigate it. Religious people, it's all voodoo on this side. And they will come and stand in front of an audience full of people whose children were crushed in buildings, talking about God's love was manifest in the fact that their children were saved, which is this backhanded slap in the face to everybody who it wasn't. And they have no explanation for it, except that makes them more righteous. I read one time back in school or whatever, 5% of all cases of cancer go into spontaneous remission. Meaning if you do nothing with cancer, about 5% of the cases the cancer will stop growing. Well, so that means if you were drinking Tahitian noni juice, it'll stop growing. If you were, praying to the Virgin Mary, it'll stop growing. If you were getting chemotherapy, it will stop growing. But no matter what you were doing, it'll stop. And people will attribute that to whatever it is they were doing. So those people who are a statistical anomaly will then become more powerful in the community. Because the other people are tend to look at them and say, well, look at Brother Johnson, his children survived, that they're special. They're chosen. Look at the story we give about Joseph Smith and his leg. That's exactly what they're saying is he didn't take a slug of whiskey. He saved that till later. and he was able to be saved. He was chosen. He was touched by God, right? So this, statistically shoots buckshot into this crowd and then lets us pick our religious leaders out of that and prevents us from doing anything to solve the problem.
Seems a good talk. There was a whole bunch of stuff in there.
I'll be here all week.
Should we just mention the President Monson visiting the 12-year-old cancer patient and in the hospital, giving her a blessing that she would be supported on both sides by Jesus. Mm-hmm. And then as he was leaving, he gave her a balloon that, oh no, she gave him a balloon that said, "You're great.
You're the best.
You're the best." You're the best. Yeah. One of her balloons. And then later, when she was like 18 or so.
Oh, was that when she was in remission?
It was three years later, I think. She came to visit him in his office again and he gave her a balloon.
The same, with the same saying. Mm-hmm. And then he sealed her and a spouse together. Mm-hmm. He was
The stories about Monson are really cool, but I know people who've had experience with Monson that are complete opposite.
Yeah. And there's
huge temper and it's just.
There's lots of people that visit sick kids in the hospital and help them feel better.
Monson said again, "Oh, we're in troubled times." Guys, all right. Here's the Larson rule. You just got roped into this one.
Oh, me.
No, okay. No, because my rule from now on for everybody in the world, if they don't want to get poked in the nose by me, is if they're going to say these times are troubled or the morality is slipping, they have to name me a year in which times were less troubled than now. Because it's true, there are problems. But what year are you going to put out? Yeah. You know, 1917, 1413? I mean, we can't constantly be having our morals go down and down and down.
Yes, we can. We're at war with Eurasia.
When was the... We've always been at war with Eurasia. When was the last time there was a public hanging? I know the answer to that. It's 1956.
Well, in the U.S., I'm sure it happens in parts of the world.
Yeah. But I mean,
of course, the U.S. is in the moral decay, so you'd expect it to be
right. I have no doubt that the morals are always shifting. And for people who draw a moral line at one place and not the other, then they it'll look like a downward shift. But they don't pay attention to the morals that are shifting in other directions.
It doesn't serve their purpose.
Right. You know.
You need to turn to the church to save yourself from the awful world. And if the world's getting better...
Yeah, the church is a dispenser of medicine that has full interest in always keeping their patients unwell.
What do they call that when you have it was in The Sixth Sense where that woman was like feeding bleach to her kid to make her sick.
Munchausen's by proxy.
Yeah.
The church suffers from a big case of Munchausen's by proxy.
They cure the well, they don't cure it. They treat the illness.
But they make you you're ill first. Yeah.
But they're making you sick.
Yeah.
They're making you sick.
Yeah. Well, they're never going to let you get better, which is the problem that I have with all psychologists.
Oh, yeah, that too.
What interest do they have in you getting better?
Yeah.
Monson did declare that he's not
dead yet.
No, he's not more than mortal, but he was chosen by God. He did make that clear.
All right. Well, I just want to those were the talks of the time. I just want to wrap up briefly with my overall impression of conference. I'll say this after watching conference rather closely now for 3 years, and then something has changed this conference.
Yes. It's a war against the secularism.
They're scared, mm-hmm. and they acknowledge several times that things have changed, that their history is being read, that the media is watching them, that, you know, they even took on things like the Big Bang. not a good move for you, Dr. Nelson. You're going to get skewered on that one.
There's a talk I need to go listen to.
Yeah. He said basically the Big Bang was ridiculous.
And the conference center all laughed. So all you bastards out there who are apologists who tell me that the church is all evolutionist and there you had 30,000 people laughing at the Big Bang. So we know where the church is. 6,000 years. Go, whoop. But the tone and tenor has changed and.
Yeah, they sound a little bit more frightened and a little bit, I was hoping that they would be more willing to talk about some of the issues, like you said. All I heard was really the way Joseph Smith translated the Book of Mormon. They didn't even say, some of you may have heard that Joseph Smith put his head in a hat to translate they just said, it doesn't really matter how he translated the Book of
Mormon.
Don't worry about that. That doesn't matter. What matters is that the Book of Mormon is divine.
We're still the source for truth. And this goes to my rant from 10 minutes ago. They won't tell you what that truth is. They won't deal with the hard questions, you know.
Right.
And, you know, the hard question is not where should your hemline be? It's
why did Joseph look in a hat using a seer stone?
And why didn't you let us know?
Why didn't you tell us that?
Yeah. Why not just be honest about it from the front? If it's true, it doesn't matter where he got it from.
Right. Just tell the truth.
And there's things they've been trying to make go away for a long time, like polygamy, which they want to hold on to doctrinally, but tell the world that we don't practice that. But more and more, there's getting to be higher scrutiny. And I think that this is coming home. The church for a long time had a great policy, just like a lot of organizations, of speaking to the insiders one way and speaking to the outsiders another way, presenting a one face to the outside. And that's all blowing to pieces in the age of Google. Who was it? I think
someone said, that was Google but be careful.
The priesthood.
Oh, yeah, that was, we'll review that a little later. But yeah, be careful.
Yeah. So I sense a tremor in the force. And I can see that from the outside. I think the rate at which people are leaving the church, the intelligence level and what they know is accelerating. There's a lot more people in the church who are having problems. The hit rate on all the ex-Mormon sites is going way up. The church has a huge credibility problem, and they're throwing tons of dollars at it.
Yeah, but they're using it for search engine optimization.
Right.
They're
still trying to manipulate.
They're still trying to hide
the path. Yes. Yeah. And trying to direct people to faithful sites and, you know, and
controlling
frankly,
the message,
be duplicitous for the church to use Brandon Flowers, the lead singer of the Killers, on one of their, I'm a Mormon thing is a bald faced lie, to suggest that Brandon would have any place in the church. Go listen to his music. I love the Killers. Thanks. All right. Okay. Any last thoughts?
I'm just glad it's over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Officially over.
All right. Well, Mike and Ann, thanks for coming down here to Studio 1A.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
I can smell dinners wafting through into the behind the glass doors. So we're going to go eat.
So we're a bunch of rowdy kids. So.
Yeah.
All right.
Bye.
Are we supposed to say anything else?
No.
No. All right.
We're done.
All eyes are on us. They're all eyes are on us.